From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. What are the legal ramifications of President Biden's new vaccination mandate? The new directives include a vaccine requirement for all federal workers and contractors, and a requirement that large companies mandate vaccines or regular testing for employees. The plan is the most substantial federal vaccine action in our country's history. But in America's ongoing battle over civil liberties during this pandemic, is the plan overreaching? Joining us now is Professor Dorit Rice. She's a vaccine law expert at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, we've never really seen a federal vaccine mandate like this in the United States. Does this one open up legal arguments that it infringes on an individual's civil liberties?
We will definitely see court cases that raise the argument that this infringes of civil liberties. But in that area, the jurisprudence tend to be deferential to policymakers. The courts have been very deferential to policymakers that balance individual rights with the public health. And the standard is a reasonableness standard. As long as the limit is reasonable, the policymakers can go ahead. So while we will see such claim, and while some courts may be sympathetic to them, overall, that's probably the weakest claim against the mandate.
Well, let's break down some of the arguments, and we'll start with companies and the arguments that companies might have. They can be fined up to $14,000 per violation for employers that ignore these mandates. What legal arguments do companies have against this?
I see at least three areas where companies may challenge this. First, they can challenge this by saying this is beyond the federal government's power to regulate. The federal government is using its power to regulate interstate commerce to do this, and the commerce power has limits. And federal companies can say, this is not regulating interstate commerce. This is directly trying to fight the pandemic by using a power that isn't appropriate. Second, companies can also argue that this is beyond OSHA's role. So this is going to be done by a rule by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which regulates workplace safety. And companies can say, you're not actually regulating workplace safety here. You're trying to use OSHA to increase vaccination rates, which is beyond the scope. And third, companies can argue that this rule is arbitrary and capricious because it's a response to political pressure rather than OSHA's reasoned judgment. Agencies need to make rules that are analytically sound, that have a support behind them, and are not just what the politicians want. And some companies may raise the argument that this is a political step and not analytically sound.
What about employees? I'm guessing it depends on where you live. Refusing to take a vaccine is not a protected class.
That's exactly right. But there are protections to some people who want to refuse a vaccine in the workplace. So the Americans with Disabilities Act would protect people with medical conditions that make vaccinating more dangerous. And the Civil Rights Act of 1964 may protect people with sincere religious objection. But again, since there's an inbuilt option for anyone, whatever the reasons not to vaccinate, and that's testing, that is going to be very hard to use.
We do see these exemptions play out for other vaccines. You're saying that it's actually hard to use this exemption. Why is that?
Simply because the alternative to vaccination is not being fired. It's testing. So what are you using the exemption for? Are you trying to say you shouldn't be tested? The courts haven't been particularly sympathetic to workers that don't want to be tested on the job. It's going to be easier to argue for exemptions for federal employees now because the federal government is moving to a vaccinate or you're fired mandate for federal employees. And that's where we'll see struggle around exemptions more than in the private sector where it's vaccinate or test.
I see. Republicans characterize Biden's mandates as an overreach, and many of them are threatening to sue. RNC chairwoman Ronna McDaniel called Biden's mandate unconstitutional and authoritarian. Do governmental agencies have a legal argument?
Yes, the governmental agencies have a legal argument. The Constitution does acknowledge broad power by the federal government to regulate, for example, interstate commerce. And the federal government has done broad things in the past. This is certainly new. And there are arguments against it, and it's not quite clear whether the court will accept this as an exercise of interstate commerce powers. But there is a good legal argument for the federal government that they're acting to prevent something that is affecting the United States broadly, that is affecting interstate commerce and interstate travel, and therefore they do have an argument.
Let's go back to enforcement. You talked about OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They'll have the power to enforce, but do they have the actual resources to do it?
That's always a tricky one. Federal agencies are chronically understaffed and underfunded. They may have to sacrifice other things, and how broad enforcement will be is unclear to me. But I think one of the things that this will do that may not be completely visible is give cover to businesses that want to do this, but need support, either because they're worried about backlash within the workforce, or because their state has a ban on mandating. Now they have federal cover to go forward with a ban. Is they may have to go to court and say in a court, we're trapped between the state and federal government. We need permission to require the vaccines.
Professor Dorit Rice is a vaccine law expert at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Will he or won't he retire? We are talking about Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, the liberal octogenarian. Breyer is under pressure to step down so Democrats can pick his replacement. He also has a new book out about the court and its role in a polarized America. He spoke this week to NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi, Nina. Okay, cutting to the chase here. How did Justice Breyer address the retirement question?
Simply put, he said he'd step down, but on his own terms. Breyer had a good 2020-2021 term. He wrote some very important opinions on the Affordable Care Act and student speech, and his fingerprints really were all over a couple of decisions that didn't bear his name. So it would seem that it's a good time for him to go, but after nearly three decades on the court, and to put it charitably, Democrats have been agitating all year for him to go and give President Biden a chance to name a younger liberal justice. But here's what he said.
I do not believe I should stay on the Supreme Court or want to stay on the Supreme Court until I die. And when exactly I should retire or will retire has many complex parts to it, and I'm not going beyond what I said, for the simple reason that I would like this interview to be about my book.
The upcoming term, Scott, is going to be a very controversial one, I suspect, and Breyer will likely be at the center of arguments on abortion, guns, and possibly affirmative action in higher education.
Now, Justice Breyer, of course, was on the losing side of a very big case last week. The court refused to block a Texas law that effectively bans abortions after 6 weeks. What did Justice Breyer say about that case?
Well, I posed those questions to him. The justice called the Texas abortion decision, quote, very, very, very wrong. But he also said, I wrote a dissent, and that's the way it works. Now, this case was fast-tracked to the high court through the so-called shadow docket. The process stands in contrast with the deliberative process applied during the regular term, and in fact to the lower courts as well. And Breyer criticized that process, saying it's a huge mistake to decide major things without the normal full argument. And that's a quote from him.
Now, speaking of the regular term, the court this week said it's going to bring back in-person oral arguments in October. Now, there was, Nina, a fair bit of drama during the pandemic, oral arguments by telephone, the sound of a toilet flushing in one case, as many of us remember. Do we know what the justices think in general, what Justice Breyer thinks in particular about, you know, jurisprudence from home?
So every justice who I've talked to about this has really hated doing this by telephone. They thought it was not really helpful in a lot of ways because it was not spontaneous. You couldn't get a conversation going with counsel back and forth because they were each limited to just a few minutes. And it was not the usual verbal combat that we see in the Supreme Court. Breyer was more equivocal. He told me that he preferred in-person arguments as well, though there were some positive aspects to doing it this the way they had to do it for the year, like hearing Justice Clarence Thomas ask questions in every case instead of his usual silence, and having more precise questions and answers. And remember, the court didn't even meet behind closed doors for their private weekly conference for more than a year, not until this April. And here's Breyer talking about the whole business.
I mean, we're not automatons, we're human beings. And I believe when human beings discuss things face to face and see how people are feeling about it and talk with each other, there's a better chance of working things out. There's a better chance of reaching better results. And that's true with the lawyers in oral arguments, and it's true with the nine of us when we're talking.
That's true when it's the Supreme Court, or I guess I should say the NPR newsroom.
Well, there you go. That is virtually NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg. Nina, great to be with you.
Thank you, as always.
This is Here and Now. So many of us are reflecting on our lives 20 years ago, where we were and what we did in the minutes, days, and weeks after 9/11. Mark Sasseville was a few months into his new role as Director of Operations and Lieutenant Colonel for the 121st Fighter Squadron, a unit of the District of Columbia Air National Guard. And during those crucial moments after the attacks on the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon, Sasseville and his colleagues learned of a fourth plane, Flight 93, still in progress. That's when they sprung into action. Now the National Guard's number two in command, Lieutenant General Mark Sasseville, is now looking back on the Guard's role and responding to the attacks and the role of the Guard today. Lieutenant General, welcome.
Thank you, Tanya. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
Yes. Well, of course, you didn't end up intercepting Flight 93 because the passengers of that flight devised their own plan to take it down. It ultimately crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, killing everyone on board. But those passengers averted a fourth attack. Pick up for us the moments before you found all of that out, when 93 was still airborne. What was your mission?
Well, first of all, let me start by picking up where you just left off. Those people on Flight 93 are the real heroes of the day, I believe. And it's really incredible when you piece together everything that they had to go through and absorb in the heat of the moment to realize that they were part of an attack. I think that's tremendous sacrifice, and that's part of the pain and sacrifice of the past 20 years, clearly. But in the run up to that, inside the squadron, it was a normal day. We were trying to understand exactly what was happening, and At a point, the White House Joint Operations Center called up. They let us know that there was another plane coming down the river. I'm using air quotes. And so they asked us if there was anything that we could get into the air, meaning are there any airplanes ready, have any pilots ready to go? And we didn't right then, but we certainly swung into action and got things moving. Clearly, after seeing what had happened, our thinking was if there are more airplanes, we have to stop them, and we may be the only ones who can do that at this point.
You and your wingman, Heather Penny, also known as Lucky, got into your F-16s. This was a kamikaze mission, essentially. What was the conversation you two had as you set out?
Well, there wasn't, to be honest with you, a lot of conversation. We were moving so fast. I think we knew what needed to be done at that point. We didn't have missiles that were already assembled and loaded onto our airplanes. We didn't have the standard bullets that you would take into combat with you. We had training rounds, which really, frankly, don't do much against targets. And so nobody ordered us to get into the air. We knew what they were asking, though, and we weren't going to just sit idly by and wait for the missiles. So Lucky and I were getting ready to run out to the airplanes. We had a quick conversation about how we might engage an airplane, if you will, most effectively and efficiently. And it was a quick conversation about who was going to take what part of the airplane, and off we went to get into the airplanes to get in the air as soon as possible.
Your mission didn't end that day. Can you describe for us the weeks that followed? You had to fly combat air patrols 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
We did. So that's not an easy feat, by the way, keeping two airplanes in the air for 24/7 for months. And that's continued to today. We're obviously not airborne the whole time, but we do have airplanes sitting on alert. The site there, my old squadron, is the busiest in the nation. We have over 6,000, I believe, events at this point where they have done some kind of reaction, and we are part of NORAD now. But those 20 years have the Guard's changed a tremendous amount over the past 20 years. We've reorganized, and we, the National Guard at large, are probably the most well-led, well-organized, and well-trained National Guard in history.
Lieutenant General, I want to talk more about the role of the National Guard and how it's grown over the last 20 years. But what were your expectations for your career before September 11th, and how did they shift or change afterward?
So I got off active duty at the 14-year point. I had a fantastic career. I enjoyed every day that I was privileged to be in uniform. And I thought that I could have the best of both worlds, frankly, a civilian career with the airlines. I was a Delta airline pilot at the time and a part-time aviator for the 121st. And so I thought that I would get to my 20 years, retire, and continue my life serving as an airline pilot. After 9/11, my outlook on life changed dramatically. My sense of purpose, my sense of duty really kind of took on a new meaning at that point, when I realized, as many did that day, that our homeland was no longer sanctuary. It hadn't been before that, but I think really 9/11 brought all of that home and reinforced that notion. So that changed the trajectory of my career. I certainly didn't expect to be where I am today, I'll tell you that, but I did know that my desire to serve took on a new meaning for me.
Well, you say that you didn't expect to be where you are now. You're now Vice Chief of the National Guard Bureau. And the role of the National Guard is just so expansive. We're also seeing troops help with pandemic response, setting up field hospitals and mass vaccination sites, and responding more frequently to natural disasters. Going forward, do you think the National Guard could or should be more focused on domestic missions like that?
So that's a great question. I think it's important for everybody to understand, all of your listeners, that the history of the National Guard really goes back hundreds of years. And the shape it started in 1636 as a militia of the colonies has really morphed over time into what we see today. We were not always the National Guard. That's really a development over the past 100 years, let's say. And so what that means is that job number one is to answer the nation's call. And so it's a tremendous asset that the country has, that everybody has a piece of. No one person, no one entity really drives, but everybody's got a part of that. And so really your question is, where will the nation take us? What does the nation want from its National Guard? Does the nation want to continue to reap the benefits of the past 20 years of investment in terms of training and equipment, and to maintain the National Guard as an operational reserve, which it has become? Because the payoffs are tremendous. And as you've seen over the past year plus, our COVID response, everything that we've been asked to do, by the way, and we haven't missed any of the taskings, either answering the nation's call in overseas deployments or a governor's request for support. Again, always ready, always there. And so really the question is, what does the country want from its National Guard going forward? And I think that's a national discussion to have.
Lieutenant General, you have a painting in your office that depicts the morning of September 11th, and it shows an F-16 pilot looking down at a burning Pentagon after Flight 77 crashed into that building. What is the daily message that painting is telling you?
So that's a great question. And I'll tell you from a personal perspective, when I look at that painting, that's the picture that I saw. The dimensions are exactly what I saw on that day. And so I'm left with two thoughts. The reminder of that day, smelling the the smoke and fumes coming up from the Pentagon, from the burning Pentagon, into the cockpit. So I was that close, I could smell it. At the same time, I was getting nauseous. I realized, though, that at some point I wasn't getting nauseous because of the smoke and the fumes. I was getting nauseous because I'd realized that we'd been attacked. And we had been well attacked. This was a disaster from a military perspective. We did not defend the country that day. And so then that leads me into what I continue to hold on every day when I come to work, which is we can never let something like that happen again. We cannot get caught by a failure of imagination. I don't think the next attack will come in the air domain. It could, right? And we're taking steps. We have taken steps over the past 20 years. There's a whole command out in Colorado Springs, NORAD NORTHCOM, that's designed to prevent that. What I worry about is where will the next attack come from? And I'm sure there will be. They happen every day in the cyber world, small scale ones, but where will the next big scale attack come from? And so that's why I continue to serve. I know that's why a lot of people from my generation are still in uniform, because they think that they can make a difference and that we can do something to help prevent something like that ever happening again. And I think that's really the charge for the next generation, to make sure that we don't forget our past and are condemned to repeat our future.
That's Lieutenant General Mark Sasseville, Vice Chief of the National Guard Bureau. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tanya. Good to speak with you.
During the pandemic, a lot of people adopted pets to get through it. The exact numbers vary as to how many. But now many of those same people are going back to work. So, who's more anxious about this, us or our pets? Here's Savannah Ciccarella.
When Melissa Alm returned to the office 2 months ago, her Chihuahua Dachshund Mix would scream at the door when she left for work.
He would do this really high-pitched yelp. Like, everybody in my apartment complex could hear him. Like this yiping.
She's had Ivan for quite some time, and he's always been a big ball of anxiety. But this yelping devastated her as she left the house every day. And at work, she couldn't stop worrying about him. It was almost as if he passed his stress onto her.
I'm constantly worried about, you know, his health and his psyche and, you know, is he going to be okay?
In the past year, a lot of Americans adopted pets, and owners got to spend a lot of time with them, one of the few bright spots of the pandemic. They've started asking veterinarians how to make the transition easier on their animals. They're even using pets as a reason to continue working remotely. Jessica Abernathy is the president of the National Association of Professional Pet Sitters.
I feel for everybody that adopted a pet during the pandemic and has to go back to work, because it's almost the equivalent of having a newborn child. And after your maternity leave is up, you have to go back to work. It's so that anxiety of going back to work, and it's like, is my baby okay?
Abernathy says her customers are constantly calling and texting to check in on how the pets are doing and how they're behaving. They're usually fine, she says, relieved even to be in the company of someone else.
Fido would absolutely love to take a nap with nobody around.
But separation anxiety in animals isn't a made-up thing. It's very real, especially for those that were adopted during the thick of the pandemic, who never had much socialization, or those who suddenly got to spend a lot more time with their owners. Here's Jill Goldman, who specializes in animal behavioral therapy.
The abrupt change in the owner's schedule can trigger stress and anxiety because it's a new thing that the animal now has to deal with.
Goldman has seen pets pacing excessively and destroying household items. And sometimes they're just mopey, like Cody. He's a mutt that lives with Johns Hopkins University professor Adam Charles. He recently went back to work.
He stopped eating his breakfast, like he was nervous in the morning that we were all going to leave him.
Owners shouldn't be too concerned about separation anxiety. Goldman, the animal behaviorist, says it can be corrected with time. Owners can gradually increase time away from pets to help them cope with their absences. And some might now have the opportunity to correct that behavior, as the latest COVID surge has delayed many office reopening plans. As for Professor Charles, who teaches biomedical engineering, He offers a completely whimsical and unscientific theory. Maybe dogs might be orchestrating the whole thing.
Somewhere the dogs are all so sad that we're starting to go back to the office, that they're trying to find a way to keep us home with them and, you know, keep their time with us. And so they're developing all these variants to try to, you know, reinstitute the shutdown, keep us all home with them so that they can have their midday walks 5 times a day with with their favorite people.
The jury's still out on that one. For NPR News, I'm Savannah Sicarella.
Now that the U.S. has left Afghanistan, is the war on terror over? Well, 2 decades into it, our next guest argues no. We remain in a post-9/11 forever war because the policies and narratives after the attack shaped the public conversation and eventually led to the rise of one Donald J. Trump. That is according to investigative journalist Spencer Ackerman. His new book is Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. And Spencer, let's go straight to the title here. What did 9/11 activate in the culture and in the machinery of government that you say connects to the rise of Donald Trump?
From the start, the war on terror functioned as a doorway to the most nativist, the most violent, and the most racist aspects of American history, gave them license to pursue power in the atmosphere of righteous patriotic violence, and the mechanisms of the government that are meant to safeguard our freedom, our rights, and our security transformed tremendously so as to provide for extensive suspicionless surveillance, the creation of a large law enforcement informant network in places of worship, such as mosques, the transformation of immigration from a means of producing more Americans into a security context that threatened those that were already here, and so on, until ultimately a series of authoritarian possibilities were provided by the war on terror, and its culture justified their use.
And as you kind of describe in your book, it's permanent war. Now, as far as Donald Trump, are you arguing that he understood this nativist context in this September 12 reality that America's in? Of course, we all remember years ago he made this birther claim, fact-free, that Barack Obama was a Muslim born in Kenya.
He really understood the subtext of the war on terror better than most politicians, or at least he was the one who wanted to celebrate and exploit that subtext while more mainstream politicians wanted to kind of ignore it and pretend that it wasn't there. In addition to birtherism, which we should have to remember, gets its force by the fact that it's calling Barack Obama a secret foreign Muslim at a time when the culture of the war on terror held such people as threats to American security. He was a leading figure stoking fear amongst New Yorkers against a Muslim cultural center in downtown Manhattan that he and others referred to as the Ground Zero Mosque. And in general, while simultaneously supporting and claiming later that he never supported the overseas wars, he consistently referred to how they needed to be fought with ever more brutality.
Okay, now, you, of course, were a part of the Guardian reporting team that won the Pulitzer for your reporting on Edward Snowden's revelations about the National Security Agency. I want to ask you about the role of the security state as, kind of a spine of this story. I mean, how was this hyper-surveillance justified and how has it endured these decades?
Well, certainly it was justified when it became public, which was years after it began, on the idea that it was necessary to stop terrorist attacks. George W. Bush called it, after the fact, the Terrorist Surveillance Program, a name that propagandistically suggests that only terrorists were under surveillance when no such thing happened. Instead, there was NSA capability unleashed that allowed it to hoover up without discrimination a tremendous amount of Americans' communications data under the name of this emergency. And then over time, the more of it that got exposed, ultimately, more of it was normalized in some degree by law in 2008, but more generally, the surveillance achieved a kind of escape velocity where the NSA, as it currently stands through a program called PRISM that we in the Washington Post exposed thanks to Edward Snowden, the surveillance piggybacks on the servers of major social media and internet data giants, which basically mediate through everything that you and I use on a daily basis, the kind of cost of doing business in the 21st century economy. So what starts after 9/11 as a, frankly, illegal, and they knew it, program, no matter how much they wanted to lawyer it away, now is embedded in the architecture of the 21st century economy.
And I want to ask you about, I guess, your thoughts on the different ways there have been costs to this war on terror. I gather you might consider these American digital freedoms and liberties part of the cost on this. But more broadly, do you think about the overt and the hidden costs to Americans of this forever war period?
So much of what we've experienced after 9/11 has been the steady erosion of democratic safeguards that are meant to keep the freedoms that Americans think they possess in perpetuity. These have just sustained sledgehammer blow after sledgehammer blow, usually from an acquiescent judicial system, usually from a political and journalistic infrastructure that typically, more typically than not, goes along with the prerogatives of the war on terror far more than they challenge it. And as a result, you get a very brittle democracy, deeply divided, lying in wait for an authoritarian figure like Trump, and as the war on terror progresses, like future Trumps, who will take the opportunities presented by both the culture and the institutional structure of the war on terror, what's already been normalized as well as what remains on the horizon, and do something with it. And they may turn out to be far more competent than Donald Trump was.
Can I come back to this, I guess, the cultural framework as part of this? You describe Donald Trump and others understanding this nativist framing here. But I think our listeners might be surprised that you're right about the role of others on the left and in the center of the political conversation. How do you think about President Obama's role in continuing this framing?
When the war on terror was established shortly after 9/11, it occurred with overwhelming support and extremely minimal criticism from the Democratic Party. That persisted for a tremendous amount of time and resulted
in
the leadership for the
Patriot Act and so many other these authorizations of war.
The Iraq War, the authorization to use military force that has become a wellspring for all of this. Obama sought to jettison the Iraq War and jettison torture by the CIA and the military. Outside of that, he was pretty flexible and ended up ratifying much, much more of the war on terror than he ended up jettisoning, becoming synonymous with drone strikes, returning to war in Iraq and adding Syria onto that list of active battlefields.
And finally, let me ask you then, where you think this framework of emergency goes from here? Does this go on, or is there a way for some of these forces that are aligned to eventually come to an end?
Well, the record over the past 20 years shows that elite politics will only perpetuate the war on terror. If the war on terror is to be stopped, it's got to come from ordinary American citizens organizing together and demanding a binary choice out of their candidates for political office. Either those candidates can maintain the war on terror or they can enjoy political power, but not both. The only thing that has restrained the war on terror substantively has been politicians feeling the pressure of popular anger and frustration over the wars. Biden, even while withdrawing from Afghanistan, talks about an enduring counterterrorism capability that spans the world and is unconstrained by any time limitation. That's been a pattern throughout the war on terror. Think about Obama seeking to withdraw from Iraq while escalating in Afghanistan. Typically, rescission on one or other war on terror battlefield is accompanied by escalation elsewhere, or even maintenance of the same enterprise from, as the Pentagon likes to say, over the horizon.
The book is Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. The author is Spencer Ackerman, and provocative read. Spencer, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Something that has never happened before is happening in reality TV. Six people of color have banded together on the show Big Brother, and last night, they all made it to the final round, systematically voting out every white contestant along the way. And there's backlash over this from some fans. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us for more. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
Big Brother has been running for 23 seasons. Contestants live in a house together. They scheme and plot to evict others until one person comes out on top. Now alliances happen along the way over time. But this group is unique for sticking together since week one. How remarkable is that?
Well, the interesting thing about Big Brother, or, you know, one of the sort of built-in flaws of the show, is that it's been around for so long that people who know the show know that if one group can kind of get control and form a powerful alliance early on, then they can basically run the competition in a way where it's not obvious what they're doing until it's too late. In a recent episode, one of the black contestants talked about what they had been doing and kind of admitted it to the camera. Let's listen to what he's saying.
Even though the cookout's been official since week one, it feels good to make it officially official. But at the end of the day, only one member of the cookout will be getting rain and confetti on finale night. And I plan for that to be me.
Yeah, that's what the Alliance of People of Color Inside the House are calling it. They're calling it the cookout. That quote kind of happened where someone had kind of slipped up and sort of mentioned to the white person that was left in the house, hey, you're the only white person left in the house. And so then they started talking a little more openly about their alliance.
Historically, Big Brother has been accused of treating contestants of color unfairly and of downplaying the racism expressed by some white contestants. Now some fans think that what we're seeing here with the cookout is doing what amounts to reverse racism against white people. Your thoughts?
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, I think the show encourages tribalism and hands the advantage to the group that practices tribalism quickest and most effectively. I've been criticizing Big Brother for many years. I wrote a book in 2012 that featured a black woman who had competed on Big Brother, and she talked about how unfair the show was for people of color because white people would form an alliance, they would vote out people of color, and then CBS, often they would edit out moments where white contestants expressed racism, so it would kind of disguise what they were doing. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about this moment is that you don't get the sense that CBS is doing that. They are showing moments inside the house where the black people are talking to each other, and it's obvious that it's an alliance that's, in part at least, is built on ethnicity. And rather than change the structure to make racism more difficult, they evened up the numbers. Mm-hmm. So it's possible now for black people to do what white people have been doing on that show for 22 seasons. So I think this is a sign that Big Brother needs to take a much more serious look at the actual structure of the show, where an alliance of people gets together and votes out people that aren't part of the alliance.
Eric Deggans has spoken. There you have it. I think that's
the last word on
that.
If only they would listen.
Right. While we have you, we wanted to ask you about Showtime's new drama, American Rust, which premieres this Sunday. It stars Jeff Daniels as a cop investigating a murder in an old Pennsylvania steel town. Eric, what do you think of this one?
Well, I will say I wanted to like it a lot more than I actually did like it. We're seeing a fair number of TV shows that are trying to depict the struggles of working class white people in small towns in America. Now we're getting American Rust. Here we have Jeff Daniels. We have a clip of him talking to a guy from a bank who was trying to auction off homes that had been in foreclosure in a public auction, and a bunch of guys showed up some of them who had lived in those houses with guns to intimidate people out of buying the houses. And so the guy from the bank goes to the sheriff, who's played by Jeff Daniels, and says, what are you going to do about this? And then they have this conversation. So let's check it out.
Seems like people decided they weren't interested in buying your stuff.
You think those men had something to do with it?
Could be.
Are you kidding me?
I'm agreeing with you. Could be. They're getting together showing off a deer rifle. That's just one of the social practices in this part of the state.
I'm from Pittsburgh. I think I understand this part of the state.
Point of fact, we're a lot closer to West Virginia than we are to Pittsburgh. More ways than geography.
So in a way, this seems kind of odd that he's so nonchalant about a bunch of guys with guns showing up as the bank is trying to auction off the homes that they lived in. You know, I've only watched a few episodes of this. I love the actors. I'm just not sure that they have a lot to work with. And I feel like sometimes we get these stories that are so relentlessly depressing that you don't really get at the joy that can come from being in a community where you know everybody. And you may be worried about your future. You may not have a lot of money, but it's not like everyone is completely dysfunctional and there's absolutely no hope. So American Rust is kind of a confused narrative. I don't think they've worked it out, but I think Hollywood's getting there. The fact that they're trying to tell these stories, I think, is important. We just have to press them to do a better job and not look so much like these entitled liberal rich people who feel guilty, and so they create something that isn't authentic.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now.